Welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Razor's Edge by William Somerset Maugham. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Mick Brown, a writer for The Daily Telegraph in the United Kingdom. He's the author of several books, including Tearing Down the Wall of Sound, The Rise and Fall of Phil Spector, and The Spiritual Tourist, A Personal Odyssey Through the Outer Reaches of Belief. His brand new book is The Nirvana Express, How the Search for Enlightenment Went West. He joins us by Zoom as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Mick, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Thank you, John. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Why is The Razor's Edge by William Somerset Maugham a great book?
That's a big question. I think it's a marvelous book in the way in which it paints two very contrasting worlds. I mean, we'll get to the plot a little later on, but it paints two very contrasting worlds. But the book is set in the period immediately after the First World War in America and moves from America to Paris and eventually to India. But what it depicts is two very contrasting worlds. It's the world of wealth, luxury, frivolity, a world which is completely besotted with the appearance of things, if you like. And the other world it depicts is a world of renunciation, austerity, faith in something greater than oneself. Somerset Maugham observes these two worlds with, I think, great insight, objectivity, and wisdom. I think he's a very, very wise writer, as well as being a very entertaining and very thought-provoking writer.
We're going to talk about all that, these contrasting worlds, the characters, the story, the settings, the very interesting author behind this novel, which was published in 1944, and also where this book fits into a larger story about Western attraction to the spirituality of India and the East. Mick, let's start with the beginning. The Razor's Edge begins with a kind of conundrum in the opening sentences. So the book begins this way, quote, "I've never begun a novel with more misgiving. If I call it a novel, it is only because I don't know what else to call it," unquote.
Right.
Now, the conundrum here is that this is not a preface or an author's introduction. This is the start of the novel itself. And our author, William Somerset Maugham, is also our narrator and a character in the story, which sounds kind of postmodern. Let's begin with this basic question of, is this book fiction or nonfiction, or what's going on here?
That's a really interesting question. I think you could call it metafiction. It's a novel that pretends in its own way to be factual, but at the same time is constantly reminding you that it's fiction. But it's also a novel which is steeped, very interestingly, I think, in Maugham's own experiences and in a particular change that happened in Somerset Maugham's life. He doesn't actually address that personally in the book, but by reading the book and reading about the things that interest him and where these subjects take you, I think that becomes very apparent. So it's sort of autobiographical without being autobiographical, if that makes sense. But it certainly reflects very much something that Maugham came to be in his life, very much, I dare say, passionately interested in, which is Indian spirituality.
Our main character is Larry Darrell, whom the narrator, Maugham, calls, quote, "a man with whom I was thrown into close contact only at long intervals," unquote. Who is Larry Darrell?
Larry Darrell, he's a really interesting character. As I said, this is set begins in America in 1919, and he's an aviator who has fought in the First World War and returned to America, and critically, having seen his best friend die in France, where he's been fighting, and he comes from a well-to-do, prosperous background. He's engaged to a very beautiful girl called Isabel, and it appears that he has the world at his feet. As the book progresses, we see that he turns his back on that world and goes off in search of something much more meaningful. One might say he goes off in search of a higher truth. But in telling this story, Maugham weaves in this very touching love story. Primarily a love that Isabel has for Larry, which is never going to be fulfilled. It's a sort of unrequited love in a way. So we have that going on, and we have an interesting sort of cast of characters, including this character, Elliot Templeton, who in a way symbolizes in the book most radically the world of luxury, the world of frivolity. Elliot Templeton is an aesthete. We think he's an art dealer, although that's never made exactly clear. But he's someone completely infatuated with status, with royal families. He's a terrific snob. In many ways, he's the most entertaining character in the book, to my mind. But he plays he's a very important foil in this story, I think. And I think you can say in some ways that these two worlds that I've described, the world of Larry Durrell, who goes off in search of faith, and the world of Elliot Templeton, who is very much rooted in the world of wealth and luxury, and they reflect two sides of Somerset Maugham's character in a way, because Maugham was a very interesting author. At one point, he was the biggest selling English language author in the world. I mean, he was a phenomenally successful author, phenomenally successful playwright, and he lived on a scale that it's hard to imagine any novelist of today living on. He lived in great luxury, but at the same time, traveled the world. So that's kind of Elliot Templeton's world in a way. But I think at the heart of Somerset Maugham was always this search for something beyond that, a search for faith, which he never really found in his life, a fascination with faith, I should say, and a search for faith. So in a way, this book is very much a reflection of Maugham's character and the character that he's, I guess, yearned to be.
Larry's spiritual questing in the book begins in a curious way. He's back from the war, as you mentioned. He's having this kind of existential crisis. He's in Chicago, and he decides he's not going to look for work. He's not going to seek a job, but he's going to loaf. This is a key word in the book. He decides he's going to loaf. What is loafing? What is he trying to do here?
It's a great word, isn't it? Loaf. It suggests an infinity of meanings, really. I think in this context, it means to appear to do nothing, to take one's time finding out who one is, to explore. In his case, he begins to explore literature, and he spends an inordinate amount of time in libraries, absorbing all the great kind of works of literature from the 18th, 19th century. I think it means that he's someone who is taking time to find himself. So while loafing around might suggest a kind of purposeless, slightly lazy indifference to anything, in fact, loaf in his case means that he's very, very purposeful and very directed, but of course not in a way which Isabel or Isabel's family or anybody around him can possibly understand, because they're constantly preoccupied with the amount of money they have, with making more money, with the luxuries that this is going to buy them. So Isabel, in fact, goes on to marry another man, who can provide her with all the kind of creature comforts that she craves. There's this wonderful phrase, a square-cut diamond and a sable coat, as the narrator puts it, which sort of perfectly summarizes Isabel, as beautiful and as full of gaiety and charm and laughter as she may be. She's very much existing on the surface of things, whereas for Larry, loafing means going below the surface of things and finding out the true nature of things.
He's just a little too unconventional and bohemian for her. She can't accept it, and she still loves him, but she breaks off the engagement and marries this other guy.
That's right. Well, it's a rather desperate and futile love. Again, as one character remarks in the book, you might as well fall in love with a reflection in the water or a cloud in the sky. And there is this kind of quality that Larry has as he moves through the book of being very, I don't want to say detached, but a key factor in Indian Eastern philosophy is this idea of non-attachment, a non-attachment to things, not allowing yourself to be sort of deflected from things or diverted by things. And so he does have this, what to their eyes appears this very, very dreamy, detached, but I would say non-attached kind of quality to him. He loves Isabel. And at one point in the book, he says to her, look, you know, you can turn your back on all this stuff and we can go off and we can explore the world. He wants to go to Greece. You can come, we can go to Greece. We don't need all this money. We don't need all these things. We can live a bohemian life. But this is not something that interests her, but something that very much drives him.
Now let's get Larry to India, because that's where a lot of the interest in this book lies. he doesn't just loaf around Chicago for the rest of the book. He leaves, he goes to France. How does he get to India? That's a strange choice, I would think, for an American military veteran to go off to India after the war, but that's what he does. How does he get there? Why does he go?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It'd be a very dull book if he just loafed around in Chicago. Nothing much would happen, I don't think. First of all, he goes to Paris, which plays a pretty key role in the book. And he goes to Paris and he loafs around there. And to the horror of Isabel and to the horror of Elliot Templeton, whom he meets in Paris, he doesn't sort of live high on the hog. He lives in a sort of rather squalid kind of impoverished surroundings and eats in cheap cafes and so forth. But at the same time, he's absorbing all this knowledge that he wants. And then he sets off across Europe and he works in a coal mine. He does manual labor. He meets a Benedictine monk. And this, I think, is what really ignites his sort of interest in pursuing a sort of spiritual life. And so it is that he eventually finds his way to India. And there he meets someone who directs him to the ashram of a guru called Sri Ganesha. And he spends some time with Sri Ganesha. And that's a really pivotal moment in the book because he begins to understand and delve deeper into Advaita philosophy, Hindu philosophy, and really sort of comes to some sort of sense of purpose for himself and some higher meaning of the world. By higher meaning, I mean a way to sort of escape all the entrapments of the world, to escape this constant restless search of happiness through the pursuit of things and to find happiness in this philosophy that he discovers.
Now let's turn to the author, the actual author, not the narrator, the actual William Somerset Maugham, born 1874, lived until 1965. As you mentioned, he was an enormously, wildly successful author, novelist in the 1930s, was living in a kind of splendor even when he was writing and as he was moving toward the authorship of The Razor's Edge, which comes out in 1944. But The Razor's Edge is based in part, as you said, on an episode in his own life where he went to India. So Mick, how did William Somerset Maugham himself go to India? Why did he go and what did he discover there?
As a novelist, as a writer of short stories, Maugham had always adopted a rather kind of jaundiced view on the world, very alive to the foibles and weaknesses of human nature. But at the same time, I think there had always been this inner kind of questing for something beyond that. He was very interested in the lives of the saints. And this emerges, of course, in the book in the form of Larry, where Larry talks about having read about the lives of the saints, Saint Ignatius and so forth. And this is very much Somerset Maugham talking. Throughout his career, throughout his life, he traveled extensively in the East. He traveled in Indochina, traveled in Malaya. He traveled in all the sort of British colonies in the East, apart from India. And so when he went to India in 1936, 37, that was the first time he'd actually been there. And it's indicative, I think, that what had interested Maugham in his previous journeys around the world, who would meet rubber planters, people who own tea plantations, he'd meet colonialists, as well as meeting more sort of demotic people, for want of a better word. But he didn't go to India in search of Maharajas and shooting tigers and all the sort of things that might have been customary for a man of his standing to be doing in India. He spent his time in India visiting temples, encountering yogis, talking to people about Indian philosophy. And eventually he was in what is now Chennai. He was told that he should go and meet somebody in the South called Ramana Maharshi, who was generally acknowledged at that point to be a saint, a very, very saintly figure. And so Maugham made the journey down to see Ramana Maharshi. And an extraordinary thing happened when he got there. He was waiting to go into the hall where Ramana Maharshi sat for very long periods of time in a state of samadhi or bliss. And Maugham fainted. And so he was carried to the hut of an English disciple of a Maharshi called Major Chadwick. He'd been a major in the British Army before going to India himself. And he rested there, and eventually Ramana Maharshi, having heard of this, he came in to meet Maugham. And they had this rather extraordinary exchange where Ramana Maharshi basically sat there in a state of sort of blissful silence. And he makes this remark, silence is also conversation. And this is a remark, of course, which finds its way into the Razor's Edge. Now, subsequent to this, word spread throughout India, in fact, that having come to see Ramana Maharshi, Somerset Maugham had fainted. And the word was spread that he'd been so overcome to be in the presence of Ramana Maharshi or in anticipation of being in the presence of Ramana Maharshi, that he himself had gone into a state of samadhi, a state of bliss. And Maugham was very, very amused by this, and he explained that he had a heart irregularity, which meant that he fainted fairly frequently, and that if he'd gone into the state of bliss and a recognition of infinity, he had no idea what it was, because as far as he was concerned, he'd just been unconscious. But his visit to Ramana Maharshi obviously made a very, very deep impression on him. The figure that the guru in A Razor's Edge is very, very much based on Ramana Maharshi, even down to the physical description of him as this short, slightly lightly skinned Indian, a man with cropped white hair, a fairly sort of portly figure, sitting there in a dhoti. This is exactly the description that Larry gives the narrator of Sri Ganesha in A Razor's Edge. And this is the description that Somerset Maugham gave of Ramana Maharshi when he subsequently wrote about him in an essay called The Saint. If anybody is interested to read The Razor's Edge and wants to know more about this, I'd really recommend that they should read Somerset Maugham's essay, The Saint, because this gives a very interesting and a very concise explanation about how he found Ramana Maharshi. As Larry says in The Razor's Edge, that he'd read the stories of these saints and always been intrigued by them, but never met a saint. And this is exactly what Somerset Maugham says in his essay, The Saint, that he, throughout his life, had read the stories of the great saints, but he'd never met a saint until he met Ramana Maharshi.
One of the curiosities about this episode, Maugham's visit to India, and then also the topic of The Razor's Edge, at least for me, is that this fascination, this interest in Indian spirituality takes place about a generation before it becomes a big deal in Western culture. Because when I think about Western fascination with Indian spirituality, my mind goes to the Beatles and what they did, right, with the Maharishi and all that. And of course, there were other figures interested and so forth, and the Beatles were following what other people did and so forth. But this experience of Maugham and then The Razor's Edge seems to be about a generation ahead of its time in terms of this interest.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, really? Because it's the period of what we might call the Roaring Twenties, when you'd have thought that there was very little interest in Eastern spirituality. I mean, the fact is that there had been Indian swamis, Indian gurus who'd gone to America as early as the late 19th century, notably Swami Vivekananda, who had appeared at something called the World Parliament of Religions in the late 19th century. And he caused a sensation. He was mobbed by women, which is very interesting. And I think that's a whole other subject, really, is the fascination which Indian gurus had on Western women, particularly Western women of a particular class and status and comfort. And I think perhaps there's an element there of Western women seeing something in this sort of romanticized figure of the guru, which they may not have seen in their rather staid, corpulent, materialistic husbands. But that's another subject. So there had been this fascination with Eastern spirituality, you know, going back to then. Emerson was very interested in the Bhagavad Gita and wrote about the Bhagavad Gita, Walt Whitman as well. But you're right, there hadn't been, as far as I know, there hadn't been a popular story in fiction about this quest, you know, taking a Westerner and putting him on this quest. In Germany, of course, Hermann Hesse was writing a book called Siddhartha, which is kind of contemporary, a little bit after the period, at least, that Maugham is writing about, which is about the Buddha. I think it's very interesting that in the 60s, when there was this growing interest in Eastern spirituality, as you say, primarily through the Beatles and then various kind of pop stars, Pete Townsend and so forth, taking up this interest, Siddhartha was one of those books that you would find on kind of bookshelves in hippie bookstores. The Razor's Edge isn't. And I think the reason for that is because Morm was essentially an Edwardian character. His language is very mannered. The milieu that he's describing is very much of that period of the early 1920s. It moves from Chicago and then to Paris, and there are lavish descriptions of the life in Paris and what wine you should be drinking and what food you should be eating. You know, this is the world of Eliot Templeton. So I think for some reason that kind of escaped the attention of all those people who were packing themselves off in VW vans and driving across Europe and Asia to get to India and sit at the feet of gurus. But it's a really, really interesting book. I mean, I loved it, and I've read it since I read it in connection with my book, and have come to love it even more because it works on so many levels. It's a love story. It's a story about manners. It's a story about culture, and it's a story about search. And the end of the book, Morm goes off on this in conversation with Larry. Imagine conversation with Larry. He goes into quite a detailed description of Advaita philosophy, non-duality, of the things that drew Larry and the life that, having learned all that and having absorbed all that, that Larry now intends to lead as a consequence of that. And the life that he intends to lead is very much turning his back completely on the life of comfort that he originally came from, that Isabel and Eliot Templeton and so forth still inhabit. The speculation is that he's going to go off and drive a taxi back in Chicago. Very honorable profession, driving a taxi, but very different from the kind of life as a broker that seems to be held out to him at the beginning of the book.
Indian spirituality is an enormously complex concept. It's a massive country full of millions and millions of people, of course, and spirituality means different things to different people there. When Larry goes and has this experience, is his takeaway point a kind of anti-materialist point? Just, you know, turn your back on the world? Is it that simple, or is there more to it than that?
I think there's more to it than that, although that's the sort of the practical consequence of what happens in his case. I don't think it necessarily is a blueprint for an interest or a belief in Indian spirituality, although, of course, that is a central part in Hinduism, where there are these different stages of life that someone is supposed to go through of the householder, the person that earns a living, that's in the world, and then at a certain age turns their back on the world to pursue the life of the ascetic and the spiritual searcher. I think there are very, very few people in India who actually do that. There's this thing called Shangri-La syndrome about the East and about Indian teachings and about Tibetan Buddhist teachings. This sort of very idealized view that Westerners often hold of it. And when you actually get to India, you realize that while religion is an intrinsic part of everyday life, there are shrines on every street corner, the lives of the stories of the gods, of which there are many, many, many in India, play a very important part in the lives of everybody. And, India is a place of business and commerce and all those kinds of things. But it is fascinating. And I think it's always held out there's always been this kind of romance of the other for some people in the West, that India seems to hold out a promise, a solution, an answer, if you like, to some of the existential problems that assail us in the West about the pursuit of happiness, about how we're constantly falling into the trap of believing in things that don't turn out to be true, this trap of allowing the contingencies in our life to actually dominate the way we think. And Indian philosophy, Hindu philosophy, I should say, and Tibetan Buddhism, which of course is very rooted very much in Advaita philosophy. These philosophies seem to offer a solution to those problems and how happiness might be found beyond the material things of life and beyond the hurry-scurry life that we live in the West.
Your new book, Mick, is The Nirvana Express. When I hear the word Nirvana, I think not of the Beatles. I think of the 1990s grunge band Nirvana. Your book does, of course, discuss Somerset Maugham and The Razor's Edge. what is Nirvana, and does Larry find Nirvana in the novel?
Yeah, Nirvana is very much, that's very much a Buddhist word, a word in Buddhism. The long-term objective, if you like, of this search of this way of life, central to Hinduism and to Buddhism, of course, is the notion of reincarnation, and the idea that one is reincarnated through countless lifetimes until one actually begins to get a grip on things, if you like, and to get to the reality of things, reality with the capital R. And at that point, one is able to step off this kind of endless cycle of rebirths and then become at one with Nirvana. And Nirvana is, it's wrong to sort of describe it as heaven, but Nirvana is a state of oneness with, I didn't even want to say the universe. It's a very hard concept to sort of to give. In Hinduism, there's this idea of Brahma, and Brahma is, for want of a better word, God. And so to cross cultures from Buddhism into Hinduism, Nirvana would be seen as being an immersion in God, or a complete realization that God is within one, and that throughout all these endless cycles of rebirth, we've been deceived by our own egos, by our own misconceptions about the reality of things. I'm sorry to get into the philosophy of it in quite such detail. So Nirvana isn't a word that would appear in The Razor's Edge. I mean, a word that does appear is Samadhi, S-A-M-A-D-H-I. And this is a state of kind of bliss and a state of oneness. And we're told that that Sri Ganesha, as indeed was said of Ramana Maharshi, he spends a long time in a state of Samadhi, which is a state of sort of separation from the things that are going on around him, and a state of bliss, a state of unity with this oneness with Brahma. So Samadhi would be the term in Hinduism. Somebody who knows much more about Hinduism than I do is going to perhaps listen to this and say, this guy's got it all wrong, but I'm doing my best here.
So how did you discover this topic, the topic of your book, I mean, the Nirvana Express, which discusses Mom and the Razor's Edge is an important part of the story, but it's a much broader story. How did you discover this topic and then come to want to write a whole book about it?
Well, it's something I've always been interested in. It all begins, I guess, with the Beats, Blame Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg. Ginsberg, of course, was very interested in Indian philosophy, went to India. Kerouac was very interested in Buddhism. And I think at the time that I was growing up, coming up through my late teens, early 20s, what you've been talking about, the Beatles and all of that stuff, you know, was very much in the air, and I was very interested in this. Subsequently went on to write a book called The Spiritual Tourist, which details a series of journeys I made in India and elsewhere, encountering different gurus and different sort of belief systems, coming finally to a conclusion that I don't know what I believe. But that was a very interesting book to write. And since then, I've written another book called The Dance of 17 Lives about the politics of reincarnation in Tibetan Buddhism, focusing particularly on the life of a Lama called the 17th Karmapa, who is very much alive now, and was embroiled in a tremendous argument within his school of Buddhism about whether he is the authentic Karmapa or not. I mentioned Shangri-La syndrome a little earlier on. Once you start delving into Tibetan Buddhism, or the politics of Tibetan Buddhism, any sense that there's idealism throughout all of this, you know, will be very quickly put to one side. The politics of Tibetan Buddhism make the politics in America or Britain look like a teddy bear's picnic. You know, there's a lot of subterfuge, a lot of deceit, a lot of plotting. But despite that, you know, there are people I think who I've met who are shining examples of humanity and shining examples of how one should conduct oneself in life and how one should behave. So the crumbling of Shangri-La syndrome, if you like, you know, was not enough to dissuade me from the impression I had from these people. But what I was trying to do with the Nirvana Express was I was very interested in, as you mentioned, in the history of this, in tracking the history of this fascination, Western fascination with the East, and in telling that story through the stories of what appear to be random and disparate people, but whom are all connected in some way, going back to Swami Vivekananda, Annie Besant, Aleister Crowley, who some of your listeners may know was a sort of occultist and sort of a so-called black magician, Alan Bennett, who was a great friend of Aleister Crowley's, who became the first Englishman to become a Buddhist monk in Burma. Then going through Timothy Leary, LSD, how LSD influenced this search and filtered into this search. And finally ending with Rajneesh, who I think is a very interesting character. So it's a mixture of sort of saints, seekers, and charlatans, if you like. But I enjoyed writing it, which is the best I can say about it.
The idea of Shangri-La comes from a different novel called Lost Horizon by James Hilton, published in 1933. And that book, I should say, is the subject of an earlier episode in this podcast series. So listeners may want to check that out. Mick, let's wrap up with one more question about The Razor's Edge, the novel. And it's this: what is the case for reading that book now?
As we've said, it's a book very much of its time in its setting, in the manners of its characters. But I think its themes are absolutely timeless, you know, and the themes are about love, about frustrated love, about materialism, about how misleading it can be to sort of follow a life as Elliot Templeton does, a life of kind of idleness, luxury. I'd like to say he gets his comeuppance, but he doesn't, of course. He's perfectly happy, and he dies a happy man. So it's not moralistic in that sense. And I don't think Somerset Maugham is making any kind of moral judgments about that. But it's also a book that, of course, discusses this idea that of going off and finding something more than the immediate world around you, of challenging yourself to think beyond your limited horizons and to look over those horizons, lost horizons maybe, but to look over those horizons. So I think those are sort of eternal questions. And it's just a really entertaining book, and it's beautifully written, and it's a fascinating insight into the period and the manners of the period. Maugham is a terrific writer. There's a reason why he was such a phenomenally successful writer. The best of the second raters, as he described himself, rather modestly. I think he's a first rater. And I think people will get enormous enjoyment and fascination out of reading this book.
Mick Brown, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Razor's Edge by William Somerset Maugham.
My pleasure. Thank you, John.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through our website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @heymiller. And last of all, a special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.